I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Filmmaker Jonathan Olszewski spent a decade filming the Rainey family. Christopher, also known as Quest, his wife Christina, their daughter PJ, Christina's son William, and his son Isaiah living in North Philadelphia. This is a loving and busy and tight-knit family in a neighborhood where gunfire is common and an everyday sound. Olszewski's documentary Quest is an intimate, even quiet portrait of this family as they go about their daily lives. Quest delivers circulars and is a music producer and promoter. Christina works at a homeless shelter. PJ goes to school. There are neighborhood block parties and barbecues and basketball games. The film also reveals how they deal with the harsh realities of their community in a city with the highest poverty rate among the country's biggest cities. Quest is having its Philadelphia premiere this Friday at Landmark's Ritz at the Bourse and will be seen next year on public television's documentary series, POV. Let me introduce our three guests. With us here in our Philadelphia studio is John Olszewski, documentary filmmaker. This is his first feature film, and I loved it. And John, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm so excited to be here.
Thank you so much. Also with us is Christopher Quest Rainey, and he, of course, is featured in this film, owner of EverQuest, a recording studio here in Philadelphia. Quest, it's great to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm glad to be here also.
Nice to have you with us. And PJ Rainey is with us as well. She's the daughter of Quest. She graduated last year from Constitution High School, has an interest in music. And PJ, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks.
You're very welcome. Quest, let me begin with you. You lived with this guy and his film for, or his camera, I should say, for about 10 years now. What's it like to see your family on the screen?
Well, at first it was kind of strange, like when I really grasped the whole aspect of the whole situation. I looked at it like, okay, wow. I thought this was going to be more like a home movie or something like that, but then it kind of really grew. So, yeah, it was strange at first, but getting adjusted to it, it seems to be okay.
And living with someone with a camera.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You forget the camera after a while because you become friends, you know, so that's what helped out a lot. So I really forgot the camera.
Really?
Like maybe within the first week and a half, you know, of him, you know, actually doing some film, and I kind of like lost track that he had a camera there because we even talked, and sometimes he was so silent you didn't know he was in the room.
How about for you, PJ? What do you make of this film?
Me, I just...
It's your family, right?
I'm sorry. Say the question again. I was on live trying to...
You were multitasking.
Yes,
that's
I'm
okay.
So sorry.
What do you think of this film?
I feel like this film is good for me because it changed me in a good way because I got more empathy for people because of my situation. It changed me a lot. And when I see people with disabilities, I understand. And I just want other people to understand, and I want them to get from the movie the point of, like, the neighborhood needs help, like, and the people, too, because there's a lot of people that have, they're a product of the environment, mm-hmm. and they need help, and it's like, some of it's not their fault. Like, I wouldn't blame everything on them. I mean, most of it, some might be, but, I mean, it's good to have role models. And we need more role models. And it's more stuff than just basketball and studio stuff.
There's lots of stuff going on there. And that's something I definitely want to talk about. John, let me turn to you. How did you find this family?
Yeah, we kind of found each other. I was 2006. I was teaching a photography class in the neighborhood. And, you know, to grown-ups. And after class one day, one of my students, this guy JC, was like, hey, you know, my brother runs a hip-hop studio out of his house a couple blocks away. Do you want to meet him? So I'm like, okay, sure, let's check it out. So we walk over, he knocks on the door, you know, Quest opens up and sees this, you know, at the time, like 25-year-old kid, like with a camera. It's like, what's going on? And we had a bit of an awkward initial sort of interaction where we exchanged business cards. And, you know, he got in touch, you know, a couple weeks later and was like, hey, would you mind coming and taking some pictures of the guys while they're recording?
Still pictures.
Still pictures. Yeah. This started off as a still photo project. And I was like, yeah, sure. I'd be happy to do that to help promote them, promote their work. And then when I first came to the studio, I was just blown away by the community, the passion, and was like, any way I can contribute to this, like, I'd love to do it. And so that just, you know, got the ball rolling.
When you talk about community, and it's clear looking at the film that that is what we see. This is a not just a tight-knit family, but in many ways a tight-knit community that watches out for each other, that cares for each other, but living in a difficult part of Philadelphia.
Yeah, and you know, like the you know, kind of the way that North Philly gets defined, you know, is often kind of you focus on the difficulties or whatever. And what I'd experienced even before I met the Rain is just the beauty of the neighborhood, the beauty of the people taking care of each other. Sometimes when the system fails, and you know, that's the kind of story I want to tell. This quiet portrait of this family taking care of each other and how they create community and how they create art together. And I really just wanted to reflect, you know, that beauty.
Well, let me play a little clip from the film, and this is UQuest talking about growing up in Philadelphia, but specifically talking about your mom.
When I was growing up, our dad wasn't really around, but I was fortunate, you know. My mom really raised us right. She taught me, instead of doing something destructive, do something constructive.
That's a great and powerful message. To do something constructive.
Yes, it was very true, definitely. The good thing about this this film is everything is very true. There's nothing acting, nobody had any punchlines or anything to say. So it was kind of weird hearing me hear myself say that, you know, reflecting on something that my mother said to me. But yeah, it's very true. You know, you don't want to, like, what's the purpose of learning all the knowledge just to die with it? You know, each one teach one, I believe. You know, and our neighborhood really needs to be taught. And I believe a lot of neighborhoods need to be taught, but specifically because I live in our neighborhood, sure. I see the damage that's been done over the years from politics to, you know, just infighting or whatever, just, you know, so, you know, conflicts in the neighborhood. So I really do, you know, really believe in that. You know, we really need to sit down and teach people what we know, the knowledge that we have, spread it out, show the love. You know.
I really like we meet you and your wife, and you're talking about the fact that there's much you disagree on, but you are, I mean, like a lot of couples here, but that you are determined to love each other, to care for each other, to create this family for each other.
Yeah, my wife and I, we both come from rocky past, and, you know, it's a story in itself there. But we really wanted to, when we got together and decided to, you know, make our bond official, we both agreed that we wouldn't bring our past relationships into our future. We would also try to be as open and honest with each other as possible. And, you know, we've both been down that road of being cheated on so long. Like, who wants to go through that again? So that was an easy task to overcome. So, you know, we're very faithful. And, you know, we love each other with all our hearts. And we're trying to just spread that love through the neighborhood.
Well, and John, I'm curious about you. You spent 10 years off and on, but basically 10 years with this family. Obviously, 10 years ago, you didn't know what you were going to be filming. Or what was going to happen or not happen?
Yeah, I just, you know, early on, I always knew there was something really special there. You know, just the connection that we made, and I just enjoyed spending time, you know, with this family. But we just kind of, you know, we had this shared, you know, kind of vision of, like, we want to tell the story. We want to, you know, kind of tell a story out of North Philly that has all of the layers. And, yeah, you know, for many years, there was a lot of uncertainty. It was like, at first, it was like, let's make a film in the neighborhood for the neighborhood. And over the years, things kind of developed and changed, and, you know, it was a ride, you know, and things got intense and real, too, a couple years into it. And we just, again, wanted to tell the story from the Rainey's point of view rather than sort of, you know, from an external point of view.
Let me play another scene from this film. And again, this is UQuest. You have this rapper you are working with, a guy named Price, and we see the kind of ups and downs of your relationship and also his life as well. Mm-hmm. And here's just a scene where you're getting frustrated with Price.
We did hundreds and hundreds of songs together. I know what he's capable of. He should have been out there. Like, he would have been one of the greats right now. I think if Price would have stayed sober, I think we'd probably have been somewhere a little bit further off and into the music business a little bit deeper.
And you have to really give him some tough love.
Yeah. Yeah, Price is definitely a really good friend of mine. Actually, we were talking to each other yesterday and reflecting on a lot of things that's going on. And the hardest part about the studio is, like, that was just one scenario. We have many scenarios where many people come through and they express their problems, or, you know, they might need help, or, you know, anything from filling out job applications to, you know, business cards or whatever the case may be. If I can help you guys with it, that's what I'm there for. Mm-hmm. And like in Price's case, like, specifically, Price is really, really very talented. Like, if somebody would just took the time to notice him before things would have happened, I could imagine where he would be at right now. You know, his songs are so warm and so heartfelt, and they speak to specific topics that people are confronted with every day. So, you know, I really hope that, you know, in the future that, you know, he can get that album out like he wants to.
Well, it seems like there are a lot of prices in North Philadelphia.
Yes.
I mean, that's one of the things that I took away from this film is, as unique and loving as you are as a family, that there are a lot of people in this neighborhood like Price who have talent. Mm. They need support,
yes.
Opportunity.
Yeah, that's what we have, little of, little support, little opportunity. And that's what we're trying to change now. We're hoping that, you know, through this film that we can do some big changes in North Philadelphia. Like John said, he didn't come here just to make a film and run. He came here to, you know, help community where he's felt loved, where he came and felt like there's something special there, you know. So hopefully someone else will see that.
There is a really upsetting, tragic part of this film. And I'm not going to give too much away, but PJ, you get shot. And what we see in your film, John, is President Obama talking about the children who were murdered in Sandy Hook. We hear him, we see that, and we remember that. And then the next shot is PJ in the hospital.
Yeah, it's just a really hard moment to live through.
It is.
And in the family, you know, when I heard about it, you know, and just after crying and just... we got in touch. Was like, what can I do to support you guys? And Quest was like, bring your camera into the hospital. We want
to document.
Yes,
this,
yeah, because pretty much that wasn't part of the film at all. You know, and I literally like contacted John when we talked or whatever. Because I remember when I first told him, he couldn't believe it. I don't think you were in town yet.
I was out of town.
It was like a shocking moment for everyone. You know, because like PJ is like the Ferris Bueller of our neighborhood. You know, so she, you know. She's very, you know, likable.
I can see that.
So to find out something happened to her, you know, everybody has to question, like, okay, now enough's enough, and this is too far. What's going on?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
PJ, we're almost up in a break here, but was that a hard part of the film for you to watch, to see?
Yeah. Now that I look at it, though, I just feel as though, like, it makes me look back and reminisce certain parts because, like, certain facial expressions and stuff might make me remember what I was thinking around that time. But now... I'm not in that place no more.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I look back and I'm like, the movie gave me, like, a chance to travel around the world. Like, I never got to do that before. Like, I only been in, like, basic places before, like Jersey or something. Like, yeah, so that's like nowhere.
Jersey. I don't know how Jersey feels about that, but I know exactly what you're talking about. Well, let's take that break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about this new film, Quest. Jonathan Olszewski is with us. He's the filmmaker, and I should add that Quest is having its Philadelphia premiere debut tomorrow at Landmark's Ritz at the Bourse here in Philadelphia. Joining us, Christopher Quest Rainey, the father, featured in this film. He also is the owner of EverQuest, a recording studio, a real hub in this neighborhood in North Philadelphia. And PJ Rainey, his daughter, with us as well. She just graduated from Constitution High School in Philadelphia. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking about this brand new documentary, actually 10 years in the making, having its Philadelphia debut tomorrow. It's called Quest, and it's subtitled An Epic Portrait of an American Family. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. PG, let me go back to you because it's something that your dad says that you said when you were shot and you apologized to him. You said, I'm sorry I got shot, Daddy. Do you remember saying that?
Yes.
Why did you say that?
I mean, I didn't go in shock or nothing. Like, I mean, I did go in shock because, of course, like, I felt it at first. Oh, man.
You're right.
Give it away.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, that's fine.
But, all right. So, I said sorry because I was just like, I was just in the moment. I was like, everything, I just wanted my mom and my dad.
Yeah, when you wanted happened. Them there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, and that was the only thing I was really saying when it happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, from one parent to another, I mean, the thought of a child being hurt in any way is just beyond despair and upset.
Yes. And I never thought I would, like me as a parent, I never thought I would experience it, you know, in my neighborhood. I always thought it would, you know, happen to the next person. Right. So no one ever really, you know, sees that coming. And when it happened, my wife and I were at home. I had just got finished helping my cousin with a little project, so I was a little dusty. I was in the shower. My wife went to the store. I heard the gunshots while I was in the shower. My wife came in the house as I was getting out the shower. I said, let me go to the door and make sure it's okay. So when my wife came in, I was like, did you hear those shots? She was like, yeah, honey, I was in the store. But I said, okay. When we came in, we, you know, low with the pole, we never thought of, you know, anything happened to PJ at the time. So at about three minutes later, a bang on the door, bang, bang, bang. It was one of PJ's friends. Her name is Portia. And she said, PJ got shot. And we just ran out the door. We didn't even know where we were running at. You know, we just ran around the corner because we know that's where they were shooting at. My wife ran completely past the block. I ran and I happened to look out the corner of my eye and I seen the gentleman. It's a gentleman around the name. His name is Michael. I don't know his last name, but he was the one that actually was the first person on the scene to assist PJ after getting shot, because PJ was going to attempt to run the other way to come home. But he knew the
to
guy
get back
knew,
to mom and dad.
Yeah,
right?
The guy knew running with a bullet in your head could just make the bullet travel or whatever case may be. So.
Yeah, and I mean, for you, PJ, here you are. You survived it clearly. But what we see is when I found this so intimate and moving and something I could relate to, which was your parents wanted to throw you a big party when you got back from the hospital. You just wanted to be home. You just wanted some quiet. And we see your parents see that in you and let you have that.
Right.
You know, it's a really sensitive moment. Did they ever find the killer? Or the shooter, I should say.
No, unfortunately, our neighborhood, no. It kind of went unanswered. It's still a reward.
There's a reward
out, yeah, for anyone who knows anything about what happened to her. Like, we know the general neighborhood and, you know, because all the guys come to the studio. We know some of the guys that were involved. And, you know, they may even still come to the studio. We don't even know.
Well,
but
that must be really just unsettling.
In a way, it's more like, okay, if you don't make peace with yourself, you never get over it. So.
Yeah, you made peace with it
to the best
ability. Of your ability.
I don't want to see anyone hurt by it, you know, just because what happened to her. But
sure,
I definitely, you know, it's upsetting about it.
Yeah, indeed. What was it like for you, John?
I think when I first heard, it was like devastated, and then when I showed up, I was just like so happy that PJ was alive, you know, and so those first kind of moments, I was just like, she's here, right. She's survived. And then I think when she came home, that's when it really hit me that, like, right, this is something that she's going to have to live with for the rest of her life. And, you know, and two, Quest asked me to be there. It's like, I do my job. I've got to, you know, let's record this. Let's, you know, want to, you know, be true to the experience. And I think, you know, part of, you know, telling this story is like, you know, the media, you know, covered it, you know, and you have this sort of sensationalized depiction of it. And I think that this film was an opportunity to tell, share this experience from their point of view, from PJ's point of view, from Quest and Ma's point of view. And I think that there's something really powerful in focusing on the quiet moments, you know, within the context of something so intense. And I think, yeah, that the film as a whole is a focus on universal moments so that we can build bridges and connection through kind of stories.
Let me play another clip from the film, This Is You, Quest, and you're discussing, frankly, the conditions in North Philadelphia, and this is after PJ is shot, and again from the new documentary called Quest.
This seems like nobody cares about this little section of the city, except for the police officers doing their job, you know. Other than that, the only time politicians come down here, they build in a new building.
For what?
But so they can build another prison or a casino? They have no problem getting a license for a casino, but all they ask for is to have somebody there after school so the kids can have something to do. It's ridiculous.
Hard to disagree with that.
Yeah, and it still seems like it stands true to this day. You know, we're getting all the new fancy buildings, but what are the children getting out of it? You know, I haven't seen a new school go up. I haven't seen a new library open up. I don't know. You know, what do you say? You know, but they're building plenty of high rises and places to make money. You know, but what are the kids getting out of it?
Here's a comment from Kate. Thank you for sharing the story of this beautiful family. You can join us as well with your comments at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. We do see police in your neighborhood. And we see, in fact, with UPJ, we see you posing with one of the police officers. We see them give after you've been shot, they give you some money, you know, to help you out.
Yeah.
And then we also see you, Quest, being questioned by the police.
So to speak.
How would you describe that?
Manhandled, maybe? I don't know. I don't know. That in particular time was really bizarre. I was putting out trash, and they just pulled up and said, hey, you fit the description. But, you know, if anybody is familiar with North Philadelphia, everybody wears T-shirts and jeans in North Philadelphia. So, you know, they said you wore T-shirts and jeans and a hat. That's my regular everyday wear. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know if I stood out or stood in. But, you know, at times you have your good police officers and at times you have your questionable officers. You know, I'm not here to judge. I just want, we could make them all good police officers. That's all I can say.
Sure. Yeah. Hard to argue with that. John, you've shown this at film festivals, many film festivals, I have to say, and won awards for this film as well. What's been the reaction as people watch it?
I think, for me, the incredible thing, and the Rainies have been, part of this, kind of exhibition process, is just, after a screening, people just connect, and especially afterwards, like, they come to the Rainies and are like, I really related to that moment, and they share their own stories. And I just, I'm just so excited that, this film is creating opportunity for connections and building bridges and allowing people to see themselves in the lives of, this family. And I think that's really powerful. And I hope that beyond sort of just passive viewing that people, maybe it kind of sparks, kind of changes in how people think about neighborhoods like North Philly, and then hopefully inspires, change. Like, how can I actually connect? How can I actually do something to contribute to this place that I am a part of? We're a part of, each other. And let's actually make decisions and also policy that acknowledges that truth.
One of the things that you said in an interview, John, is about this film is you thought it was a film about listening, which I really liked and I connected to. And you do see this family, this community, people not just talking with each other, but they are listening to each other. And it does, it makes that happen.
I think it's really important. It's important for us to listen to each other and know each other and share stories from either end of whatever, perceived divide, there might be. And so I hope that the film can just be an opportunity for more dialogue, more listening, and more sharing.
You agree with that, Quest?
Yeah, actually I do. I'm actually open to the idea of everybody seeing the film. Like, I want everybody to see what they can get out of it and what they can take away from it. The Q&As that we have after the movie is really awesome to us because people go in with a dull sense. Okay, here's another film, but when they come out, it's so much light and so much to them. Now everyone wants to tell a story. Everyone's a book writer and everyone's a poet and everyone's an artist. And that's the lovely part about it, the conversation and dialogues afterwards.
Does that surprise you?
It really surprised me. Yeah, because it was a few cities where we went to and, did a couple screenings and for film festivals. And, you could see the crowd go in and just, quietly, null and dull, so to speak. But when they come out and the conversations and the questions that they ask, and this one guy, he was 7'2", and he's like massive, 300 pounds. When he came and gave me a hug, he could have swallowed me, and he cried on my shoulders and told me, what a lovely film it was. And then that really changed me a lot because he wasn't even from America, so that was really interesting, it touched me a lot.
How about for you, PJ?
Wait, what was the question?
That's okay. No. I have to say that she's doing Instagram while the whole show is going, which is actually very, very cool. But what's it like to see people's reaction to this film, when you're a part of it, such an important part of it?
Yeah, I feel like I didn't think that this was going to really be this big. So it's just surprising seeing people act like that. And it's like, all right, so when we did a screening in Philly, I thought,
this was in your neighborhood, right?
Yeah. We did a screening at this church, and it was a couple people there that I knew that was, around my age, but they was from around the neighborhood. And then that's when they was asking questions. At first, I thought being as though everybody in my neighborhood, they go through, like, it's normal to them, probably. So, like, when they watch it, they probably like that. I've been through that before.
Right.
So I felt as though, like, most of the time, the people that, the crowd that we would get would be, like, the, I don't know, like, the politicians or something. Not the politicians, but, like, I don't know, higher people.
The leaders or the whatever?
Yeah, because, I don't know, people just got the same mental, and they just probably, like, that's any movie. Like, I don't know. I don't know how to explain it, but yeah. It's like people, teenagers got the same, you know.
Way of thinking, so to
yeah.
speak.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one of the reasons, I mean, I've always just loved documentaries, and perhaps I'm a voyeur, I don't know, but just I'm always fascinated in other people's lives. I was reading, John, about how you did this. It's basically you. It's not like you had a camera crew that moved in with the Rainey family. It's basically you. And there was also, there's a lot of scenes where you're following Quest and PJ. They're, say, going to school, and you're walking backwards mm-hmm. with the camera. How do you navigate without falling in a manhole or something?
Yeah, so this is the thing. You know, this is a collaboration. There ends up being, after spending, you know, months and then years, you know, you end up getting this, you know, filmmaker subject sort of symbiosis. And so, you know, for a while, I thought I just had a great sixth sense that I can walk backwards and never bump into anything. And I mentioned that to Quest one day, maybe about a year ago. And he's like, you realize that I like navigate back and forth on the sidewalk to keep you from killing yourself.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it's like, for me, it's just like, if he ever wanted to get rid of me over those 10 years, he could have gotten rid of me.
Just take a bad step.
Yeah, take a bad step and I'm done. So it's just like, but it's something that we did together, you know, and also too, beyond just us, you know, in the later years, just building a team around the film with my producer, Sabrina Schmidt-Gordon, and my editor, Lindsay Utes. You know, it's just like, you know, it's just this amazing collaboration, starting with North Philly, but then bringing this great filmmaker team to kind of, you know, pull it all together.
And as a filmmaker, you just film and film and film and film and film and then figure out what you got.
Yeah.
And how many hours of film would you say?
It's pushing 400 hours.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. You can't kind of, you know, it's like you're mining, you're getting this raw material, and then you need to figure out where are the diamonds, you know? And there's some moments that while I was filming, I just know this is just a precious, beautiful moment. And there's other things that maybe I dismissed, you know, and then we rediscover in the edit. And so that's sort of a whole kind of wild process.
Were you involved in that at all, Quest, of just out of curiosity, in terms of the editing?
Well, actually, no, it's hard for, like it's one thing John said to me that I realized that it was very true. It's hard to be a subject and then you him being a friend. And
you're friends,
right,
should say.
Right, exactly. Yes. And then trying to edit something because you don't want to take things out that you think might tell a story, but you don't want to leave too many things and that's just, okay, now we're dragging this out.
Right.
You know, because, like, if it was up to me, we would talk about the 22 puppies that we had. You know, how my mom and my pop would just argue with each other. Sometimes it's just funny listening to them talk about the garden and things. So, yeah.
And one thing with the film, too, is there were many versions of the film over the years. So it wasn't like the first version of the film was released, you know, 10 years in. So the Rainies, like, saw, like, early version in December 2007, and we talked about it. And, you know, then there was another version maybe a year later. We talked about that. So, so we had a lot of dialogue, and I really felt like we talked a lot about what do we want to reflect? What do we want this thing to do?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could have filmed this family for 20 years. I mean, at some point you had to say, okay, there's a film here somewhere, right?
Absolutely. And that's what the film team, you know, that's why I needed a team because they were like, all right, we're ready to go. We can make a film out of this. Because, yeah, I just love hanging out with the Rainies. Like, they're just amazing friends. It's like family. And so I could have filmed for this and so for many years. And who knows? Maybe we'll do a sequel.
Yeah, exactly. Here's a tweet from D. Rainey. I don't know if that's related. Looking forward to seeing the film tomorrow night. I'm from North Philly as well. Sincerely, D. R-A-I-N-E-Y. I'm not sure if they're related to you or not. PJ, let me turn to you. As I said, you graduated from Constitution High School in, what, June?
Yes.
What are your plans? And there's a point at which you, Quest, say, you know, you like any parent, you want the best for your daughter.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. What do you want for yourself?
So I was planning on going to college. I was planning on going to community for 2 years, and then I was going to transfer to Rowan University, and John actually worked there.
At Rowan, yeah.
Yeah. So that's going to be nice. I was going to take business, and my dad always, you know, talking about doing something constructive. He always be throwing, like, properties and stuff in my head, like, you know.
He's your dad.
Yeah, I know. I understand, though. Like, I feel like I'm different from other kids because I really, like, try to listen to what he say because, I don't know, like, I don't want to, I try not to make mistakes, even though I know I will in the future, but you know.
Yeah. Well, you're a really close family.
Yeah.
You care really deeply about each other.
Right.
We're almost out of time here, but I'm just curious. Quest, you've been a music producer, promoter for years now, right?
Yeah, since 1998.
And is that something you're going to develop even further and continue to do? Or?
Yeah, because it's not just me with the studio. Like, I have a couple other guys, Eric Wiggins, George Jones.
And PJ, right?
Yeah, Tamu. It's like so many people like help us with the music and stuff like that. So I'm not really the only producer. I'm just like the head producer or, you know, EQE. So, but yeah, we definitely have plans for the future.
Great.
Yeah.
And you're working on another film with another family, right, John? six years in, right?
Yeah, I make films to make friends. I make friends, and I get to tag along with the camera. And so, I've got 6 years into another amazing family, the Fiddlers. And, looking to figure out how to, get that one done. And excited to go on another journey with them while we're continuing this one.
A tweet from Lisa, great conversation. Looking forward to see the film. Be sure to note at, anyway, we'll just leave it at that because I'm not sure what the hashtag is all about there, but be sure to note. Well, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. PJ, thanks for coming in.
No problem.
And good luck to you as
thanks
well.
For having me.
You're very welcome. PJ Rainey with us, also her father, Christopher Quest Rainey, and he's the owner of EverQuest. That's a recording studio in North Philadelphia. Thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. And John Olszewski, thank you for joining us. Congratulations on your film. First feature film, and it's called Quest, and it is having its Philadelphia debut tomorrow night at Landmark's Ritz at the Bourse. And we'll be seen next year on Public Television's documentary series, POV. Thanks to all three of you. Well, we do want to close things out. This segment of Radio Times, this is The Siege by Price and Christopher Quest Rainey, seen in the film Quest.
Tell him, hindered by poverty, snore for days, find a way to escape, surviving the pain, and let's catch the strays, let's get hit, survive, you know it's surviving, facing life, blaze the sheet, cavity knives, hoping to see another day, cause most of us die, heavy breathing, not sleeping, at night creeping, my guns, spend the time, I just saw some weakness, on the ground, niggas bleeding, for the cause of many reasons, niggas running for.
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The CHIP program provides health care coverage for 9 million children living in low-income families and several hundred thousand pregnant women at risk. The 20-year-old state-federal program, the result of bipartisan cooperation, is in peril. Federal funding for the program expired 2 months ago, and now states are running out of money. We asked David Rumid to join us. He's a general pediatrician, director of policy lab, and medical director of population health at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. David Rumid, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Help us understand CHIP, and this goes back to 1997. It was co-authored by Senators Orrin Hatch and the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Apparently it's been successful. It's been effective. Why is it in peril?
Yeah, so that's the million-dollar question right there, because if you had asked me 6 months ago whether the CHIP program would be in peril, I'd say no way. This is a strong bipartisan program, enjoys support from both sides of the aisle. And it's been tremendously successful in reducing the uninsurance rate among children in the country.
We're talking about, 9 million children and several hundred thousand pregnant women. What kind of care do they get under the CHIP program?
Well, it's interesting. CHIP was actually created because there was a real gap in terms of coverage for really working families, low and moderate income working families in the country. The Medicaid program had insured children living in poverty, many of whom whose families were making in like minimum wage jobs, et cetera. But there was this group of families whose parents were making somewhere between $20,000 a year to maybe $60,000, $70,000 a year, depending on which state you lived in, whose parents were not able to obtain affordable coverage for their children through work. And so we continued back in 1997 to have a challenge in terms of insuring all the children in this country because there was this gap if you will. And when CHIP was introduced in 1997, there was a recognition of creating a standalone children's program for low and moderate income families so that they could have access to affordable coverage for their children. And that's grown now to include about 9 million children, and it's reduced our insurance rates for children to, you know, less than 5% nationally.
Wow. And you, these are some of your patients.
They are my patients. And, you know, and it's interesting that you asked that because a number of years ago, I started to, you know, notice something else changing, something that was a little bit different, a sea change, if you will. And I think most of us who, you know, who are employed and have families recognize that at work every year we kind of do our annual declaration for insurance coverage for our family. But about 5-10 years ago, we noticed that there started to be increasing pass-alongs in terms of expenses to families if you wanted to insure your children through your employer plan. And it's gotten to the point now with high deductibles and the doubling of premiums, et cetera, from single coverage to family coverage, that many families, particularly low and moderate income families who have jobs, who have health insurance for themselves through work, either are not being offered affordable health coverage at all for their children, let alone affordable coverage. And so I started to see this change a few years ago in my own practice where families, I was noticing that the children had different insurance from their parents.
Wow.
And it's because their parents were coming and getting access to the Children's Health Insurance Program largely within the state.
Well, we're talking about the fact that it was the end of September, the federal funding stopped. There's some arguments obviously going back and forth about what the federal government will do. But in some states, I'm not sure if it's happened in Pennsylvania or not, officials are sending out letters to parents saying that they should be prepared to look for alternative coverage for health care for their children. What options do parents like this who are not, you know, poor per se, but nonetheless low income or moderate income, what options do they have?
Well, that's interesting. You know, I've been asking my families who are in this situation over the last year or so what would happen if they didn't have access to CHIP. I think some families who are being offered really expensive coverage would bite the bullet, if you will, and they would figure out how to try to get their kids covered. But there's no doubt in my mind, and we've actually studied this in a paper that was released and is available on our website at policylab.chop.edu. We actually noticed that in states that where there wasn't a CHIP program, we saw uninsurance rising among children. And that leaves the question, are we going to go back to a point where we're going to leave some of these low and moderate income families faced with the excruciating decision of whether they can even provide coverage for their children?
Because if you, I mean, this is so obvious, if you don't have insurance, especially for children, growing, developing children, what are the chances that they're going to get the medical care that they need and deserve?
That's correct. The other great thing about CHIP is that, you know, because it's a children's only program, often the children's programs within large insurance plans are sort of an afterthought. And they kind of, you know, and we have the saying in pediatrics that they treat children as like little adults. Yet their needs are so much different for what you just said. And so what the states have done in developing their CHIP programs is really remarkable. They had no requirements, but they brought together people who knew what children needed. And so CHIP plans, by and large, are very comprehensive. They include vision and dental, and they include mental health services and physical health services to support children's needs so that parents aren't shopping around for different plans in a very fragmented way.
How would you say we have listeners, obviously, in the tri-state area and beyond, but I'm interested in Pennsylvania since obviously you work in Philadelphia. How is Pennsylvania dealing with the fact that the feds have not been funding CHIP for 2 months now?
You know, I think there's a lot of accounting sort of challenges that are being faced here and moving money over here to try to shore up the program as long as they can. I know that Pennsylvania hasn't formally announced what it's going to do, but I think there are a lot of nervous state employees out there wondering if they have to send out those same letters that you were talking about and really worried about having to do so to scare families, to give any impression that children's insurance is vulnerable in some ways might sort of lead to a lot of families believing there is no CHIP program, there is no option at the state, and rolling back what has been now 2 decades in gains in terms of messaging about that program and families feeling like they have that backstop.
I'm wondering where the outrage is. I mean, this story is rarely on the front page. If anyone reads newspapers anymore, it's deeper into the newspaper. And where's the outrage about this? And where is the urgency? And you may be the wrong person to ask on this, but this outrages me.
Yeah, it should. Sometimes I think I'm a pediatrician. I'm the only one who's outraged out there. In terms of timeliness, we're watching. What's really frustrating for me, and regardless how you feel about tax reform, you're seeing a level of urgency around tax reform this week for something that would take place when we file our taxes in April of 2019, when we haven't funded a program for 9 million children that lapsed 61 days ago. And no one's talking about it.
Yeah.
And it should have broad bipartisan support. It's an extremely popular program around the country. And so I think outrage is a good word.
That's David Rubin. We're talking about the CHIP program, and you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Tell us if you are outraged or not. There are also several hundred thousand pregnant women at risk who are also covered by CHIP. How and why are they covered, and what kind of services do they get?
Because I'm a pediatrician, I'm not as familiar with the extent of the service in the CHIP program for pregnant women in terms of its wraparound to the services that are received through Medicaid in general for pregnant women. But by and large, I would say the largest group that's covered by CHIP are those 9 million children.
Yeah. And, I don't even want to contemplate this, but if CHIP essentially went away or the federal government, for whatever reason, decided not to fund CHIP, what would happen?
I think you would see some families really try to stretch their budget. I think often you'll see, we've seen evidence that parents will forgo their own health care to try to get their kids covered and access to the services that they need. So there are intergenerational impacts on how people kind of divide up the monthly balance. But if you look to the study that we released in Health Affairs in December, there was the bellwether warning. We saw a significant increase in uninsured children, the first time in two decades within states that didn't have CHIP as an alternative, as parents could no longer afford their employer coverage. And I'd encourage folks to look at that study, because to me, that is the sort of dire warning that you take CHIP away, you're going to see dramatic increases in uninsured children in this country among working families.
And is this in any way connected to the dismantling of the Affordable Care Act, or just sort of what is happening to our healthcare system overall? Is CHIP implicated in that?
It shouldn't be. In many ways, the Affordable Care Act has a very small footprint compared to CHIP in terms of children. Many states have sort of directed, families who are coming to the exchanges to, if they were eligible, to actually get their children's insurance through CHIP. The ACA is principally about adult coverage and single adult coverage. And the early experience with the ACA is that the plans that have been offered there are not as comprehensive or as affordable as the CHIP plans themselves.
Let me get, looks like Rebecca from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Rebecca. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. So I'm outraged as well. I've called my senators, and I'm curious, first of all, what else you think I can do? And also, I just wanted to comment that I originally got my kids onto CHIP in 2008 or 2009, when my daughter had a concussion and no insurance company would insure her. So it was a matter of a pre-existing condition, which is certainly not uncommon with children. Mm-hmm. So I'm concerned not only about losing CHIP, as a small business owner that's trying to, survive and does not have employer insurance. My husband and I have insurance through the exchange. But I'm also wondering, with all these ACA rollbacks, potential rollbacks, are we going to lose CHIP and then face the situation where we, with pre-existing conditions, cannot even get our children enrolled? So it's scary not just to lose CHIP, but to then to not know what options for those of us without employer coverage will have.
Yeah. David, can you respond to that in any way?
Yeah. First, I would reassure you that to me, the ACA and CHIP are completely different. And I think The first is to educate everyone that CHIP has been around since 1997. It's for children. The ACA was largely meant to address a lot of adult coverage gaps, particularly folks who were self-employed, who were low and moderate income and didn't have access to coverage for themselves through their employer, right? But they did have, they should have had access, like you just mentioned, for their children to these children's health insurance programs, and that's why they're so popular. And as to what so delinking the two is the most important thing. I think most people in Washington on both sides of the aisle understand that.
Yeah.
But the second thing is to what you can do. I mean, I've thought a lot about this. You know, it feels like the noise is so loud today to how do we advocate when there's such an outrageous issue. What we've talked about here is having people like you tell your story, because I think that when people look at public insurance for children, assumptions are sometimes made about who the recipients of those programs are. But when you look at it across the board, the overwhelming majority of people who access these programs for their children are working families,
yeah.
And particularly for CHIP. And we need to tell those stories to educate the public of why this program is so important.
Rebecca, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. As you were talking, David, I was thinking, what if children marched, I'm not suggesting this, but marched on Washington? I mean, who lobbies for children besides parents? You know, who lobbies for children?
It's really hard. It's really hard. And so, you know, when you look at it, the healthcare lens, sometimes it's hard to magnify the children's issues, because when you look at the amount of money that's spent on healthcare in the country, it's overwhelmingly among adults. So when people are looking at healthcare reform, they tend to focus on adults. When in fact, when you look, you know, some of the statistics surprise you. More than half the children in this country are covered by public insurance nowadays. And so the sheer magnitude of the children should warrant that level of engagement. As to how we kind of educate people or magnify that signal, that's been a real challenge. I mean, maybe it's a children's march, like you said, to really dramatically state that point. But, you know, far be for me to know exactly, like, the best way to advocate. But I think we need, like, we need to somehow sound the alarms in a way that we get people's attention.
But even if funding is restored, and let's hope that it is, it seems to me in a healthcare system, especially dealing with children, you need stability. You need consistency. I'm assuming doctors and hospitals, they need to have some predictability about how they're going to pay for the services they provide.
Yeah, but I don't want to make, you know, you're right. I mean, I think there's real challenges. But to me, the real loss here is the child who doesn't show up to get their immunizations, or the child who has a behavioral health issue who isn't addressed because the parents can't afford to come and have that child seen. And as a tester, I'll tell you a story about a patient of mine, because I told you I've been asking families. And this may seem like a small issue. I had a family I hadn't seen in a couple of years in my practice. Terrific family. I knew both parents were employed, and they were in this sort of segment they didn't know about CHIP or Medicaid, and went without insurance for their kids for a year or two. And their son was an athlete in high school, and he did not participate in sports for a year or two because the school required the family to get a sort of evidence of a sports physical, or an evidence of a physical and a comprehensive screening from the pediatrician. And they were embarrassed to admit that they couldn't afford that visit. They didn't come to see me. He didn't play sports that year. And then you sort of, you know, to me, it's not a life or death situation, but you think about that child's emotional self-esteem, his opportunity, his limited opportunity to kind of set himself forth in high school. There are downstream effects to the lack of health insurance to children in terms of their wellness. That to me, it's, you know, I want to steer it away from, yeah, we have challenges at the hospital in terms of uncompensated care. But it's about the fact that we've lost an opportunity to intervene to help our families.
David Rubin, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. He's a general pediatrician, director of Policy Lab, and medical director of Population Health at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, talking about the CHIP program. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.